intrinsically greater than that in pronouncing it adaptive. In other words, the former provide just not-so stories. Psychologist David Barish and psychiatrist Judith Lipton compared Spandrelites to the character Topsy in Uncle Tom's Cabin, who states that she just growed. When faced with evidence of adaptation and traits, they'd conclude that those traits are mere baggage, without adaptive purpose, providing explanations that explained nothing. Just growed stories. Furthermore, sociobiologists argued, adaptationist approaches were more rigorous than Gouldian caricature. Rather than explaining everything and predicting nothing, sociobiological approaches predict plenty. Is, say, competitive infanticide a just-so story? Not when you can predict with some accuracy whether it will occur in a species based on its social structure. Nor is the pair-bond-slash-tournament comparison, when you can predict a vast amount of information about the behavior, physiology, and genetics of species ranging across the animal kingdom simply by knowing their degree of sexual dimorphism. Furthermore, evolution leaves an echo of selection for adaptive traits when there is evidence of special design, complex, beneficial functions where a number of traits converge on the same function. All this would be your basic, fun academic squabble, except that underlying the criticisms of adaptationism, gradualism, and sociobiology is a political issue. This is embedded in the title of the Spandrel paper, the Panglossian paradigm. This refers to Voltaire's Dr. Pangloss and his absurd belief, despite life's miseries, that this is the best of all possible worlds. In this criticism, adaptationism stinks of the naturalistic fallacy, the view that if nature has produced something, it must be a good thing. That furthermore, good, in the sense of, say, solving the selective problem of water retention in deserts, is in some indefinable way also morally good. That if ant species make slaves, if male orangutans frequently rape females, and if for hundreds of thousands of years hominin males drink milk directly out of the container, it is because it is somehow meant to be that way. When aired as a criticism in this context, the naturalistic fallacy had an edge to it. In its early years, human sociobiology was wildly controversial, with conferences picketed and talks disrupted, with zoologists guarded by police at lectures, all sorts of outlandish things. On one storied occasion, E.O. Wilson was physically attacked while giving a talk. Anthropology departments split in two. Collegial relationships were destroyed. This was particularly so at Harvard, where many of the principals could be found. Wilson, Gould, Lewontin, Trivers, Hurdy, the primatologist Irvin DeVore, the geneticist Jonathan Beckwith. Things were so febrile because sociobiology was accused of using biology to justify the status quo. Conservative social Darwinism then implied that if societies are filled with violence, unequal distribution of resources, capitalistic stratification, male dominance, xenophobia, and so on, these things are in our nature and probably evolved for good reasons. The critics used the is versus ought contrast, saying, sociobiologists imply that when an unfair feature of life is the case, it is because it ought to be. And the sociobiologists responded by flipping is-ought around. We agree that life ought to be fair, but nonetheless, this is reality. Saying that we advocate something just because we report it is like saying oncologists advocate cancer. The conflict had a personal tinge. This was because by chance, or not, depending on your viewpoint, that first generation of American sociobiologists were all white Southerners. Wilson, Trivers, DeVore, Hurdy. In contrast, the first generation of its loudest critics were all Northeastern, urban, Jewish leftists. Harvard's Gould, Lewontin, Beckwith, Ruth Hubbard, Princeton's Leon Kamen, and MIT's Noam Chomsky. You can see how the there's a hidden agenda here charge arose from both sides. It's easy to see how punctuated equilibrium generated similar ideological battles, given its premise that evolution is mostly about long periods of stasis pierced by revolutionary upheaval. In their original publication, Gould and Eldridge asserted that the law of nature holds that a new quality emerges in a leap as the slow accumulation of quantitative changes, long resisted by a stable system, finally forces it rapidly from one state into another. This was a bold assertion that the heuristic of dialectical materialism not only extends beyond the economic world into the naturalistic one, but is ontologically rooted in the essential sameness of both worlds' dynamic of resolution of irresolvable contradictions. It is Marx and Engels as trilobite and snail. Eventually, the paroxysms about adaptationism versus spandrels, gradualism versus punctuated change, and the very notion of a science of human sociobiology subsided. The political posturing lost steam, the demographic contrasts between the two camps softened, the general quality of research improved considerably, and everybody got some gray hair and a bit more calm. This has paved the way for a sensible, middle-of-the-road middle age for the field. There's clear empirical evidence for both gradualism and punctuated change, and for molecular mechanisms underlying both. There's less adaptation than extreme adaptationists claim, but fewer spandrels than touted by spandrelites. While sociobiology may explain too much and predict too little, it does predict many broad features of behavior and social systems across species. Moreover, even though the notion of selection happening at the level of groups has been resurrected from the graves of self-sacrificial elderly wildebeest, it is probably a rare occurrence. Nonetheless, it is most likely to occur in the species that is the focus of this book. Finally, all of this is anchored in evolution being a fact, albeit a wildly complex one. Remarkably, we've finished this first part of the book. A behavior has occurred. What happened in everything from a second to a million years earlier that helps explain why it happened? Some themes have come up repeatedly. The context and meaning of a behavior are usually more interesting and complex than the mechanics of the behavior. To understand things, you must incorporate neurons and hormones and early development and genes, etc., etc. These aren't separate categories. There are few clear-cut causal agents, so don't count on there being the brain region, the neurotransmitter, the gene, the cultural influence, or the single anything that explains a behavior. Instead of causes, biology is repeatedly about propensities, potentials, vulnerabilities, predispositions, proclivities, interactions, modulations, contingencies, if-then clauses, context dependencies, exacerbation or diminution of pre-existing tendencies, circles and loops and spirals and Mobius strips. No one said this was easy, but the subject matters. And thus we transition to the second part, synthesizing this material in order to look at realms of behavior where this matters the most. Chapter 11. Us versus them. As a kid, I saw the original 1968 version of Planet of the Apes. As a future primatologist, I was mesmerized, saw it repeatedly, and loved the cheesy ape costumes. Years later, I discovered a great anecdote about the filming of the movie, related by both Charlton Heston and Kim Hunter, its stars. At lunchtime, the people playing chimps and those playing gorillas ate in separate groups. As it's been said, most often attributed to Robert Benchley, there are two kinds of people in the world, those who divide the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. There are more of the first. And it is vastly consequential when people are divided into us and them, in-group and out-group. The people, i.e. our kind, and the others. This chapter explores our tendency to form us-them dichotomies and to favor the former. Is this mindset universal? How malleable are us and them categories? Is there hope that human clannishness and xenophobia can be vanquished so that Hollywood extra chimps and gorillas break bread together? The strength of us-them. Our brains form us-them dichotomies, henceforth us-theming for brevity, with stunning speed. As discussed in Chapter 3, 50 millisecond exposure to the face of someone of another race activates the amygdala, while failing to activate the fusiform face area as much as same-race faces do, all within a few hundred milliseconds. Similarly, the brain groups faces by gender or social status at roughly the same speed. Rapid, automatic biases against a them can be demonstrated with the fiendishly clever implicit association test, IAT. Suppose you are unconsciously prejudiced against trolls. To simplify the IAT enormously, a computer screen flashes either pictures of humans or trolls or words with positive connotations, e.g., honest, or negative ones, deceitful. Sometimes the rule is, if you see a human or a positive term, press the red button. If it's a troll or a negative term, press the blue button. And sometimes it's human or negative term, press red, troll or positive term, press blue. Because of your anti-troll bias, pairing a troll with a positive term or a human with a negative is discordant and slightly distracting. Thus, you pause for a few milliseconds before pressing a button. It's automatic. You're not fuming about clannish troll business practices or troll brutality in the Battle of Somewhere in 1523. You're processing words and pictures, and unconsciously you pause, stopped by the dissonance linking troll and lovely, or human and malodorous. Run enough rounds, and that pattern of delay emerges, revealing your bias. The brain's fault lines, dividing us from them, were shown in Chapter 4's discussion of oxytocin. Recall how the hormone prompts trust, generosity, and cooperation toward us, but crappier behavior toward them. More preemptive aggression and economic play, more advocacy of sacrificing them, but not us, for the greater good. Oxytocin exaggerates us-theming. This is hugely interesting. If you like broccoli but spurn cauliflower, no hormone amplifies both preferences. Ditto for liking chess and disdaining backgammon. Oxytocin's opposing effects on us and them demonstrate the salience of such dichotomizing. Our depth of us-theming is supported further by something remarkable. Other species do it as well. Initially, this doesn't seem profound. After all, chimps kill males from other groups, baboon troops bristle when encountering each other, animals of all stripes tense at strangers. This simply reflects not taking kindly to someone new, a them. But some other species have a broader concept of us and them. For example, chimp groups that have swollen in number might divide. Murderous animosities soon emerge between ex-groupmates. Remarkably, you can show automatic us-theming in other primates with a monkey equivalent of the IAT. In one study, animals were shown pictures of either members of their own or the neighboring group, interspersed with positive things, e.g. fruit, or negative, e.g. spiders. And monkeys looked longer at discordant pairings, e.g. group members with spiders. These monkeys don't just fight neighbors over resources. They have negative associations with them. Those guys are like yucky spiders, but us, we're like luscious tropical fruit. Footnote. Two important points. This intergroup bias effect was demonstrable in males, but not females, and was most pronounced when males were looking at pictures of other males. Second, shortly after publication, the paper was retracted. Apparently, a data coding error called into question some of the findings. However, those described here were unaltered by this error, and I think they are perfectly valid. Out of commendable cautiousness, the authors, all top researchers, retracted the paper. Numerous experiments confirm that the brain differentially processes images within milliseconds based on minimal cues about race or gender. Similarly, consider minimal group paradigms pioneered in the 1970s by Henri Tailfel of the University of Bristol. He showed that even if groupings are based on flimsy differences, e.g., whether someone over or underestimated the number of dots in a picture, in-group biases, such as higher levels of cooperation, still soon develop. Such prosociality is about group identification. People preferentially allocate resources to anonymous, in-group individuals. Merely grouping people activates parochial biases, no matter how tenuous the basis of the grouping. In general, minimal group paradigms enhance our opinion of us rather than lessening our opinion of them. I guess that's meager good news. At least we resist thinking that people who came up heads on the coin toss, in contrast to our admirable tails, eat their dead. The power of minimal, arbitrary groupings to elicit us-theming recalls Greenbeard effects from Chapter 10. Recall how these hover between prosociality due to kin selection and due to reciprocal altruism. They require an arbitrary, conspicuous, genetically based trait, e.g., a green beard, that indicates a tendency to act altruistically toward other green bearders. Under those conditions, green bearders flourish. Us-theming, based on minimal shared traits, is like psychological rather than genetic green beard effects. We feel positive associations with people who share the most meaningless traits with us. As a great example, in one study, subjects conversed with a researcher who, unbeknownst to them, did or didn't mimic their movements, for example, leg crossing. Not only is mimicry pleasing, activating mesolimbic dopamine, but it also made subjects more likely to help the researcher, picking up their dropped pen. An unconscious usness, born from someone slouching in a chair like you do. Thus, an invisible strategy becomes yoked to an arbitrary green beard marker. What helps define a particular culture? Values, beliefs, attributions, ideologies, all invisible until they are yoked with arbitrary markers such as dress, ornamentation, or regional accent. Consider two value-laden approaches to what to do to a cow. A. Eat it. B. Worship it. Two A's or two B's would be more peaceful when sorting out cow options than an A and B together. What might reliably mark someone who uses approach A? Maybe a Stetson and cowboy boots. And a B person? Perhaps a sari or a Nehru jacket. Those markers were initially arbitrary. Nothing about the object called a sari intrinsically suggests a belief that cows are sacred because a god tends them. And there's no inevitable link between carnivory and a Stetson's shape. It keeps the sun out of your eyes and off your neck. Useful whether you tend cows because you love steak or because Lord Krishna tended cows. Minimal group studies show our propensity for generating biased us-thems from arbitrary differences. What we then do is link arbitrary markers to meaningful differences in values and beliefs. And then something happens with those arbitrary markers. We, e.g. primates, rats, Pavlov's dogs, can be conditioned to associate something arbitrary, like a bell, with a reward. As the association solidifies, is the ringing bell still just a marker symbolizing impending pleasure? Or does it become pleasurable itself? Elegant work related to the mesolimbic dopamine system shows that in a substantial subset of rats, the arbitrary signal itself becomes rewarding. Similarly, an arbitrary symbol of an us core value gradually takes on a life and power of its own, becoming the signified instead of the signifier. Thus, for example, the scattering of colors and patterns on cloth that constitutes a nation's flag becomes something that people will kill and die for. Footnote. A powerful example of this is seen in the First War of Indian Independence, also known as the Sepoy Mutiny of 1857. Indian soldiers, sepoys, serving in the British East India Company's army, rebelled when it became known that the bullets they were issued were greased in either tallow, derived from cows, or lard, from pigs, major offenses to the Hindu and Muslim soldiers, respectively. Mind you, this was not the British colonial overlords doing something offensive to the core cultural values of either group. For example, declaring Allah a false prophet or banning polytheistic worship. Virtually every culture on earth has food prohibitions, often pretty arbitrary ones meant to merely signal core values, Kosher laws for Orthodox Jews, for example, revolve around zoological arcana about whether a species has cloven hoof, but that eventually gain a huge power. Before it was over, the Sepoy Mutiny killed more than 100,000 Indians. The strength of us theming is shown by its emergence in kids. By age 3 to 4, kids already group people by race and gender, have more negative views of such thems, and perceive other race faces as being angrier than same-race faces. And even earlier. Infants learn same-race faces better than other race. How can you tell? Show an infant a picture of someone repeatedly. She looks at it less each time. Now show a different face. If she can't tell the two apart, she barely glances at it. But if it's recognized as being new, there's excitement and longer looking. 4 important thoughts about kids dichotomizing. Are children learning these prejudices from their parents? Not necessarily. Kids grow in environments whose non-random stimuli tacitly pave the way for dichotomizing. If an infant sees faces of only one skin color, the salient thing about the first face with a different skin color will be the skin color. Racial dichotomies are formed during a crucial developmental period. As evidence, children adopted before age 8 by someone of a different race develop the expertise at face recognition of the adoptive parent's race. Kids learn dichotomies in the absence of any ill intent. When a kindergarten teacher says, "Good morning, boys and girls," the kids are being taught that dividing the world that way is more meaningful than saying, "Good morning, those of you who have lost a tooth and those of you who haven't yet." It's everywhere, from she and he meaning different things to those languages so taken with gender dichotomizing that inanimate objects are given honorary gonads. Racial us-theming can seem indelibly entrenched in kids because the parents most intent on preventing it are often lousy at it. As shown in studies, liberals are typically uncomfortable discussing race with their children. Instead, they counter the lure of us-theming with abstractions that mean squat to kids. "It's wonderful that everyone can be friends," or "Barney is purple and we love Barney." Thus, the strength of us-theming is shown by A, the speed and minimal sensory stimuli required for the brain to process group differences, B, the unconscious automaticity of such processes, C, its presence in other primates and very young humans, and D, the tendency to group according to arbitrary differences, and to then imbue those markers with power. Us. Us-theming typically involves inflating the merits of us concerning core values. We are more correct, wise, moral, and worthy when it comes to knowing what the gods want, / running the economy, / raising kids, / fighting this war. Usness also involves inflating the merits of our arbitrary markers, and that can take some work. Rationalizing why our food is tastier, our music more moving, our language more logical or poetic. Perhaps even more than superiority, feelings about us center on shared obligations, on willingness and expectation of mutuality. The essence of an us mindset is non-random clustering producing higher than expected frequencies of positive interactions. As we saw in Chapter 10, the logical strategy in One Round Prisoner's Dilemma is to defect. Cooperation flourishes when games have an uncertain number of rounds and with a capacity for our reputations to precede us. Groups, by definition, have multiple round games and the means to spread news of someone being a jerk. This sense of obligation and reciprocity among us is shown in economic games, where players are more trusting, generous, and cooperative with in-group than with out-group members, even with minimal group paradigms where players know that groupings are arbitrary. Chimps even show this trust element when they have to choose between A, being guaranteed to receive some unexciting food, and B, getting some fabulous food if another chimp will share it with them. Chimps opt for the second scenario, requiring trust, when the other chimp is a grooming partner. Moreover, priming people to think of a victim of violence as an us rather than a them increases the odds of their intervening. And recall from chapter 3 how fans at a soccer match are more likely to aid an injured spectator if he's wearing home team insignias. Enhanced pro-sociality for in-group members does not even require face-to-face interactions. In one study, subjects from an ethnically polarized neighborhood encountered an open, stamped questionnaire on the sidewalk near a mailbox. Subjects were more likely to mail it if the questionnaire indicated support for a value of the subject's ethnic group. In-group obligation is shown by people feeling more need to make amends for transgressions against an us than against a them. For the former, people usually make amends to the wronged individual and act more pro-socially to the group overall. But people often make in-group amends by being more antisocial to another group. Moreover, in such scenarios, the guiltier the person feels about her in-group violation, the worse she is to thems. Thus, sometimes you help us by directly helping us, sometimes by hurting them. This raises a broad issue about in-group parochialism. Is the goal that your group do well, or simply better than them? If the former, maximizing absolute levels of in-group well-being is the goal, and the levels of rewards to them is irrelevant. If the latter, the goal is maximizing the gap between us and them. Both occur. Doing better, rather than doing well, makes sense in zero-sum games, where, say, only one team can win, and where winning with scores of 1-0, 10-0, and 10-9 are equivalent. Moreover, for sectarian sports fans, there is similar mesolimbic dopamine activation when the home team wins or when a hated rival loses to a third party. This is Schadenfreude, gloating, where their pain is your gain. It's problematic when non-zero-sum games are viewed as zero-sum, winner-take-all. It's not a great mindset to think you've won World War III if afterwards us have 2 mud huts and 3 fire sticks and they have only 1 of each. A horrific version of this thinking occurred late during World War I when the Allies knew they had more resources, i.e. soldiers, than Germany. Therefore, their British commander, Douglas Haig, declared a strategy of ceaseless attrition, where Britain went on the offensive no matter how many of his men were killed, as long as the Germans lost at least as many. So in-group parochialism is often more concerned about us beating them than with us simply doing well. This is the essence of tolerating inequality in the name of loyalty. Consistent with that, priming loyalty strengthens in-group favoritism and identification, while priming equality does the opposite. Intertwined with in-group loyalty and favoritism is an enhanced capacity for empathy. For example, the amygdala activates when viewing fearful faces, but only of group members. When it's an out-group member, them showing fear might even be good news. If it scares them, bring it on. Moreover, recall from chapter 3 the isomorphic sensory motor reflex of tensing your hand when watching a hand being poked with a needle. The reflex is stronger if it's a same race hand. As we saw, people are more likely to make amends for transgressions against us than against them. What about responses to other in-group members violating a norm? Most common is forgiving us more readily than them. As we will see, this is often rationalized. We screw up because of special circumstances. They screw up because that's how they are. Something interesting can happen when someone's transgression constitutes airing the group's dirty laundry that affirms a negative stereotype. The resulting in-group shame can provoke high levels of punishment as a signal to outsiders. The United States, with its rationalizations and ambivalences about ethnicity, provides many such examples. Consider Rudy Giuliani, who grew up in Brooklyn in an Italian-American enclave dominated by organized crime. Giuliani's father served time for armed robbery and then worked for his brother-in-law, a mob loan shark. Giuliani rose to national prominence in 1985 as the attorney prosecuting the 5 families in the Mafia Commission trial, effectively destroying them. He was strongly motivated to counter the stereotype of Italian-American as synonymous with organized crime. When referring to his accomplishment, he said, "And if that's not enough to remove the mafia prejudice, then there probably could not be anything you could do to remove it." If you want someone to prosecute mafiosi with tireless intensity, get a proud Italian-American outraged by the stereotypes generated by the mob. Similar motivations were widely ascribed to Chris Darden, the African-American attorney who was co-counsel for the prosecution in the O.J. Simpson trial. Ditto for the trial of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg and Morton Sobel, all Jewish, accused of spying for the Soviet Union. The very public prosecution was by two Jews, Roy Cohn and Irving Sapol, and presided over by a Jewish judge, Irving Kaufman, all eager to counter the stereotype of Jews as disloyal internationalists. After death sentences were doled out, Kaufman was honored by the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Jewish war veterans. Giuliani, Darden, Cohn, Sapol, and Kaufman show that being in a group means that someone else's behaviors can make you look bad. Footnote. This plays out currently with a deep resentment of many in the Muslim American community that they are especially obligated to condemn Islamic fundamentalist terrorism and will be under a cloud of suspicion if they do not. I refuse to condemn not because I don't condemn, but because doing so would mean that I agree that I deserve to be asked, states the Arab-American writer Amir Zahir. This raises a larger issue, namely our sense of obligation and loyalty to us as a whole. At one extreme, it can be contractual. This can be literal, with professional athletes in team sports. It is expected that when jocks sign contracts, they will play their hardest, putting the team's fortune above showboating. But the obligations are finite. They're not expected to sacrifice their lives for the team. And when athletes are traded, they don't serve as a fifth column, throwing games in their new uniform to benefit their old team. The core of such a contractual relationship is the fungibility of both employer and employee. At the other extreme, of course, are US memberships that are not fungible and transcend negotiation. People aren't traded from the Shiites to the Sunnis, or from the Iraqi Kurds to the Sami herders in Finland. It would be a rare Kurd who would want to be a Sami, and his ancestors would likely turn over in their graves when he nuzzled his first reindeer. Converts are often subject to ferocious retribution by those they left. Consider Maryam Ibrahim, sentenced to death in Sudan in 2014 for converting to Christianity, and suspicion from those they've joined. With the sense of one's lot being permanent, come distinctive elements of usness. You don't sign a faith-based baseball contract with vague promises of a salary. But usness based on sacred values, with wholes bigger than sums of parts, where unenforceable obligations stretch across generations, millennia, even into afterlives, where it's us, right or wrong, is the essence of faith-based relationships. Naturally, things are more complicated. Sometimes an athlete choosing to switch teams is viewed as betraying a sacred trust. Consider the perceived treachery when LeBron James chose to leave the Cavaliers of his hometown Cleveland, and the perception of his choice to return as akin to the second coming. At the other extreme of group membership, people do convert, emigrate, assimilate, and, especially in the United States, wind up a pretty atypical us. Consider ex-Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, with his rich Southern accent and Christian faith, born Piyush Jindal to Hindu immigrant parents from India. And consider the complexities in, to use a horrible phrase, the unidirectionality of fungibility. Muslim fundamentalists who would execute Maryam Ibrahim while advocating forced conversions to Islam at the point of a sword. The nature of group membership can be bloodily contentious concerning people's relationship to the state. Is it contractual? The people pay taxes, obey laws, serve in the army. The government provides social services, builds roads, and helps after hurricanes. Or is it one of sacred values? The people give absolute obedience, and the state provides the myths of the fatherland. Few such citizens can conceive that if the stork had arbitrarily deposited them elsewhere, they'd fervently feel the innate rightness of a different brand of exceptionalism, goose-stepping to different martial music. Those thems. Just as we view us in standardized ways, there are patterns in how we view them. A consistent one is viewing them as threatening, angry, and untrustworthy. Take space aliens in movies as an interesting example. In an analysis of nearly 100 pertinent movies, starting with Georges Méliès's pioneering 1902 A Trip to the Moon, nearly 80% present aliens as malevolent, with the remainder either benevolent or neutral. In economic games, people implicitly treat members of other races as less trustworthy or reciprocating. Whites judge African-American faces as angrier than white faces, and racially ambiguous faces with angry expressions are more likely to be categorized as the other race. White subjects become more likely to support juvenile criminals being tried as adults when primed to think about black versus white offenders. And the unconscious sense of them as menacing can be remarkably abstract. Baseball fans tend to underestimate the distance to a rival team stadium, while Americans hostile to Mexican immigrants underestimate the distance to Mexico City. But thems do not solely evoke a sense of menace. Sometimes it's disgust. Back to the insular cortex, which in most mammals is about gustatory disgust, biting into rotten food, but whose human portfolio includes moral and aesthetic disgust. Pictures of drug addicts or the homeless typically activate the insula, not the amygdala. Being disgusted by another group's abstract beliefs isn't naturally the role of the insula, which evolved to care about disgusting tastes and smells. Us-them markers provide a stepping stone. Feeling disgusted by them because they eat repulsive, sacred, or adorable things, slather themselves with rancid scents, dress in scandalous ways, these are things the insula can sink its teeth into. In the words of the psychologist Paul Rozin of the University of Pennsylvania, disgust serves as an ethnic or out-group marker. Establishing that they eat disgusting things provides momentum for deciding that they also have disgusting ideas about, say, deontological ethics. The role of disgust in theming explains some individual differences in its magnitude. Specifically, people with the strongest negative attitudes toward immigrants, foreigners, and socially deviant groups tend to have low thresholds for interpersonal disgust, e.g., are resistant to wearing a stranger's clothes or sitting in a warm seat just vacated. We will return to this finding in Chapter 15. Some thems are ridiculous, i.e., subject to ridicule and mockery, humor as hostility. Outgroups mocking the in-group is a weapon of the weak, damaging the mighty and lessening the sting of subordination. When an in-group mocks an outgroup, is to solidify negative stereotypes and reify the hierarchy. In line with this, individuals with a high social dominance orientation, acceptance of hierarchy and group inequality, are most likely to enjoy jokes about outgroups. Thems are also frequently viewed as simpler and more homogeneous than us, with simpler emotions and less sensitivity to pain. David Barraby, in his superb book, Us and Them, The Science of Identity, gives a striking example, namely that whether it was ancient Rome, medieval England, imperial China, or the antebellum South, the elite had the system justifying stereotype of slaves as simple, childlike, and incapable of independence. Essentialism is all about viewing them as homogeneous and interchangeable, the idea that while we are individuals, they have a monolithic, immutable, icky essence. A long history of bad relations with thems fuels essentialist thinking. They've always been like this and always will be, as does having few personal interactions with thems. After all, the more interactions with thems, the more exceptions accumulate that challenge essentialist stereotyping. But infrequency of interactions is not required, as evidenced by essentialist thinking about the opposite sex. Thus, Thems come in different flavors. Threatening and angry, disgusting and repellent, primitive and undifferentiated. Thoughts versus feelings about them. How much are our thoughts about them post-hoc rationalizations for our feelings about them? Back to interactions between cognition and affect. Us theming is readily framed cognitively. John Jost of NYU has explored one domain of this, namely the cognitive cartwheels of those on top to justify the existing system's unequal status quo. Cognitive gymnastics also occur when our negative, homogeneous view of a type of them must accommodate the appealing celebrity them, the them neighbor, the them who has saved our ass. Ah, this them is different, no doubt followed by a self-congratulatory sense of open-mindedness. Cognitive subtlety can be needed in viewing thems as threats. Being afraid that the them approaching you will rob you is rife with affect and particularism. But fearing that those thems will take our jobs, manipulate the banks, dilute our bloodlines, make our children gay, etc., requires future-oriented cognition about economics, sociology, political science, and pseudoscience. Thus, us-theming can arise from cognitive capacities to generalize, imagine the future, infer hidden motivations, and use language to align these cognitions with other uses. As we saw, other primates not only kill individuals because they are thems, but have negative associations about them as well. Nonetheless, no other primate kills over ideology, theology, or aesthetics. Despite the importance of thought in us-theming, its core is emotional and automatic. In the words of Barraby in his book, stereotyping isn't a case of lazy, shortcutting cognition. It isn't conscious cognition at all. Such automaticity generates statements like, I can't put my finger on why, but it's just wrong when they do that. Work by Jonathan Haidt of NYU shows that in such circumstances, cognitions are post-hoc justifications for feelings and intuitions, to convince yourself that you have indeed rationally put your finger on why. The automaticity of us-theming is shown by the speed of the amygdala and insula in making such dichotomies. The brain weighing in affectively precedes conscious awareness, or there never is conscious awareness, as with subliminal stimuli. Another measure of the affective core of theming is when no one even knows the basis of a prejudice. Consider the Cagots, a minority in France whose persecution began in the 11th century and continued well into the last one. Cagots were required to live outside villages, dress distinctively, sit separately in church, and do menial jobs. Yet they didn't differ in appearance, religion, accent, or names, and no one knows why they were pariahs. They may have descended from Moorish soldiers in the Islamic invasion of Spain and thus were discriminated against by Christians. Or they might have been early Christians, and discrimination against them was started by non-Christians. No one knew the sins of ancestral Cagots or how to recognize Cagots beyond community knowledge. During the French Revolution, Cagots burned birth certificates in government offices to destroy proof of their status. The automaticity is seen in another way. Consider an individual with an impassioned hatred for an array of outgroups. There are two ways to explain this. Option one, he has carefully concluded that Group A's trade policies hurt the economy, and just happens to also believe that Group B's ancestors were blasphemous, and thinks that Group C members don't express sufficient contrition for a war started by their grandparents, and perceives Group D members as pushy, and thinks that Group E undermines family values. That's a lot of cognitive just-happens-tos. Option two. The guy's authoritarian temperament is unsettled by novelty and ambiguity about hierarchies. This isn't a set of coherent cognitions. As we saw in Chapter 7, Theodore Adorno, in trying to understand the roots of fascism, formalized this authoritarian temperament. Individuals prejudiced against one type of outgroup tend toward being prejudiced against other ones and for affective reasons. More on this in the next chapter. The strongest evidence that abrasive theming originates in emotions and automatic processes is that supposed rational cognitions about thems can be unconsciously manipulated. In an example cited earlier, subjects unconsciously primed about loyalty sit closer to us's and farther from them's, while those primed about equality do the opposite. In another study, subjects watched a slideshow of basic, unexciting information about a country they knew nothing about. There's a country called Moldova? For half the subjects, faces with positive expressions were flashed at subliminal speeds between slides. For the other half, it was negative expressions. The former developed more positive views of the country than the latter. Conscious judgments about thems are unconsciously manipulated in the real world. In an important experiment discussed in Chapter 3, morning commuters at train stations in predominantly white suburbs filled out questionnaires about political views. Then, at half the stations, a pair of young Mexicans, conservatively dressed, appeared each morning for 2 weeks, chatting quietly in Spanish before boarding the train. Then commuters filled out second questionnaires. Remarkably, the presence of such pairs made people more supportive of decreasing legal immigration from Mexico and of making English the official language, and more opposed to amnesty for illegal immigrants. The manipulation was selective, not changing attitudes about Asian Americans, African Americans, or Middle Easterners. How's this for a fascinating influence on us-theming, way below the level of awareness? Chapter 4 noted that when women are ovulating, their fusiform face areas respond more to faces, with the emotional VMPFCs responding more to men's faces in particular. Carlos Navarrete at Michigan State University has shown that white women, when ovulating, have more negative attitudes toward African-American men. Thus, the intensity of us-theming is being modulated by hormones. Our feelings about thems can be shaped by subterranean forces we haven't a clue about. Automatic features of us-theming can extend to magical contagion, a belief that the essentialism of people can transfer to objects or other organisms. This can be a plus or a minus. One study showed that washing a sweater worn by JFK would decrease its value at auction, whereas sterilizing one worn by Bernie Madoff would increase its value. This is sheer irrationality. It's not like an unwashed JFK sweater still contains his magical armpit essence, while an unwashed Madoff sweater swarms with moral taint cooties. And magical contagion has occurred elsewhere. Nazis killed supposedly contaminated Jewish dogs along with their owners. The heart of cognition catching up with affect is, of course, rationalization. A great example of this occurred in 2000 when everyone learned the phrase hanging chads following the election of Al Gore and the Supreme Court selection of George W. Bush. For those who missed that fun, a chad is the piece of paper knocked out of a punch card ballot when someone votes, and a hanging chad is one that doesn't completely detach. Does this justify disqualifying the vote, even though it is clear who the person voted for? And obviously, if 1 millisecond before chads reared their hanging heads, you had asked pundits what would be the hanging chad stances of the party of Reagan and trickle-down economics and the party of FDR and the Great Society, they wouldn't have had a clue. And yet, there we were, 1 millisecond post-chads, with each party passionately explaining why the view of the opposing thems threatened mom, apple pie, and the legacy of the Alamo. The confirmation biases used to rationalize and justify automatic theming are numerous. Remembering supportive better than opposing evidence, testing things in ways that can support but not negate your hypothesis, skeptically probing outcomes you don't like more than ones you do. Moreover, manipulating implicit theming alters justification processes. In one study, Scottish students read about a game where Scottish participants either did or didn't treat English participants unfairly. Students who read about Scots being prejudicial became more positive in their stereotypes about Scots and more negative about Brits, justifying the bias by the Scottish participants. Our cognitions run to catch up with our affective selves, searching for the minute factoid or plausible fabrication that explains why we hate them. Individual intergroup interactions versus group intergroup interactions. Thus, we tend to think of us as noble, loyal, and composed of distinctive individuals whose failings are due to circumstance. Thems, in contrast, seem disgusting, ridiculous, simple, homogeneous, undifferentiated, and interchangeable, all frequently backed up by rationalizations for our intuitions. That is a picture of an individual navigating us, them in his mind. Interactions between groups tend to be more competitive and aggressive than our interactions between individual us's and them's. In the words of Reinhold Niebuhr, writing during World War II, the group is more arrogant, hypocritical, self-centered, and more ruthless in the pursuit of its ends than the individual. There is often an inverse relationship between levels of intragroup and intergroup aggression. In other words, groups with highly hostile interactions with neighbors tend to have minimal internal conflict. Or to spin this another way, groups with high level of internal conflict are too distracted to focus hostility on the others. Crucially, is that inverse relationship causal? Must a society be internally peaceful to muster the large-scale cooperation needed for major intergroup hostilities? Must a society suppress homicide to accomplish genocide? Or to reverse the causality, do threats from thems make societies more internally cooperative? This is a view advanced by the economist Samuel Bowles of the Santa Fe Institute, who has framed this as conflict, altruism's midwife. Stay tuned. Unique realms of human us-theming. Despite other primates displaying rudimentary abstractions of us-theming, humans are in a stratosphere of uniqueness. In this section, I consider how we all belong to multiple categories of us, and their relative importance can rapidly change. All thems are not the same, and we have complex taxonomies about different types of thems and the responses they evoke. We can feel badly about us-theming and try to conceal it. Cultural mechanisms can sharpen or soften the edges of our dichotomizing. Multiple us's. I am a vertebrate, mammal, primate, ape, human, male, scientist, lefty, sun sneezer, Breaking Bad obsessive, and Green Bay Packers fan. All grounds for concocting an us-them. Crucially, which us is most important to me constantly shifts. If some octopus moved in next door, I would feel hostile superiority because I have a spine and it didn't. But that animosity might melt into a sense of kinship when I discovered that the octopus, like me, loved playing Twister as a kid. We all belong to multiple us-them dichotomies. Sometimes one can be a surrogate for another. For example, the dichotomy of people who are or aren't knowledgeable about caviar is a good stand-in for a dichotomy about socioeconomic status. As noted, the most important thing about our membership in multiple us-thems is the ease with which their prioritizing shifts. A famed example, discussed in Chapter 3, concerned math performance in Asian American women, built around the stereotypes of Asians being good at math and women not. Half the subjects were primed to think of themselves as Asian before a math test. Their scores improved. Half were primed about gender. Scores declined. Moreover, levels of activity in cortical regions involved in math skills changed in parallel. We also recognize that other individuals belong to multiple categories and shift which we consider most relevant. Not surprisingly, lots of that literature concerns race, with the core question being whether it is an us-them that trumps all others. The primacy of race has a lot of folk intuition appeal. First, race is a biological attribute, a conspicuous fixed identity that readily prompts essentialist thinking. This also fuels intuitions about evolution. humans evolved under conditions where different skin color is the clearest signal that someone is a distant them. And the salience of race is seen cross-culturally. An astonishing percentage of cultures have historically made status distinctions by skin color, including in traditional cultures before Western contact, where with few exceptions, e.g. the low-status Ainu ethnic minority in Japan, lighter skin tone confers higher status both within and between groups. But these intuitions are flimsy. First, while there are obvious biological contributions to racial differences, race is a biological continuum rather than a discrete category. For example, unless you cherry-pick the data, genetic variation within race is generally as great as between races. And this really is no surprise when looking at the range of variation with a racial rubric. Compare Sicilians with Swedes or a Senegalese farmer with an Ethiopian herder. The evolutionary argument doesn't hold up either. Racial differences, which have only relatively recently emerged, are of little us-them significance. For the hunter-gatherers of our hominin history, the most different person you'd ever encounter in your life came from perhaps a couple of dozen miles away, while the nearest person of a different race lived thousands of miles away. There is no evolutionary legacy of humans encountering people of markedly different skin color. Furthermore, the notion of race as a fixed, biologically based classification system doesn't work either. At various times in the history of the U.S. Census, Mexican and Armenian were classified as distinctive races. Southern Italians were of a different race from Northern Europeans. Someone with one black great-grandparent and seven white ones was classified as white in Oregon, but not Florida. This is race as a cultural rather than biological construct. Given facts like these, it is not surprising that racial us-them dichotomies are frequently trumped by other classifications. The most frequent is gender. Recall the finding that it is more difficult to extinguish a conditioned fear association with an other than a same race face. Navarrete has shown that this occurs only when the conditioned faces are male. Gender outweighs race as an automatic classification in this case. Age as a classification readily trumps race as well. Even occupation can. For example, in one study, white subjects showed an automatic preference for white politicians over black athletes when they were primed to think of race, but the opposite when primed to think of occupation. Race as a salient us-them category can be shoved aside by subtle reclassification. In one study, subjects saw pictures of individuals, each black or white, each associated with a statement, and then had to recall which face went with which statement. There was automatic racial categorization. If subjects misattributed a quote, the face picked and the one actually associated with the statement were likely to be of the same race. Next, half the black and half the white individuals pictured wore the same distinctive yellow shirt. The other half wore gray. Now subjects most often confused faces by shirt color. Wonderful research by Mary Wheeler and Susan Fisk of Princeton showed how categorization is shifted, studying the phenomenon of amygdala activation by pictures of other race faces. In one group, subjects tried to find a distinctive dot in each picture. An other race face didn't activate the amygdala. Faceness wasn't being processed. In a second group, subjects judged whether each face looked older than some age. Amygdaloid responses to other race faces enlarged. Thinking categorically about age strengthened thinking categorically about race. In a third group, a vegetable was displayed before each face. Subjects judged whether the person liked that vegetable. The amygdala didn't respond to other race faces. At least two interpretations come to mind to explain this last result. A. Distraction. Subjects were too busy thinking about, say, carrots to do automatic categorization by race. This would resemble the effect of searching for the dot. B. Recategorization. You look at a them face, thinking about what food they like. You picture the person shopping, ordering a meal in a restaurant, sitting down to dinner at home and enjoying a particular food. In other words, you think of the person as an individual. This is the readily accepted interpretation. But recategorization can occur in the real world under the most brutal and unlikely circumstances. Here are examples that I find to be intensely poignant. In the Battle of Gettysburg, Confederate General Lewis Armistead was mortally wounded while leading a charge. As he lay on the battlefield, he gave a secret Masonic sign in hopes of its being recognized by a fellow Mason. It was by a Union officer, Hiram Bingham, who protected him, got him to a Union field hospital, and guarded his personal effects. In an instant, the us-them of Union-Confederate became less important than that of Mason-non-Mason. Another shifting of thems also occurred during the Civil War. Both armies were filled with Irish immigrant soldiers. Irish typically had picked sides haphazardly, joining what they thought would be a short conflict to gain some military training, useful for returning home to fight for Irish independence. Before battle, Irish soldiers put identifying sprigs of green in their hats so that, should they lie dead or dying, they'd shed the arbitrary us-them of this American war and revert to the us that mattered, to be recognized and aided by their fellow Irish. A green sprig as a green beard. Rapid shifting of us-them dichotomies is seen during World War II, when British commandos kidnapped German General Heinrich Kreipe in Crete, followed by a dangerous 18-day march to the coast to rendezvous with a British ship. One day, the party saw the snows of Crete's highest peak. Kreipe mumbled to himself the first line, in Latin, of an ode by Horace about a snow-capped mountain, at which point the British commander, Patrick Lee Fermor, continued the recitation. The two men realized that they had, in Lee Fermor's words, drunk at the same fountains. A recategorization. Lee Fermor had Kreipe's wounds treated and personally ensured his safety through the remainder of the march. The two stayed in touch after the war and were reunited decades later on Greek television. "No hard feelings," said Kreipe, praising Lee Fermor's daring operation. And finally, there is the World War I Christmas truce, something I will consider at length in the final chapter. This is the famed event where soldiers on both sides spent the day singing, praying, and partying together, playing soccer and exchanging gifts, and soldiers up and down the lines struggled to extend the truce. It took all of one day for British versus German to be subordinated to something more important. All of us in the trenches versus the officers in the rear who want us to go back to killing each other. Thus, us-them dichotomies can wither away into being historical trivia questions like the cagot, and can have their boundaries shifted at the whims of a census. Most important, we have multiple dichotomies in our heads, and ones that seem inevitable and crucial can, under the right circumstances, have their importance evaporate in an instant. Cold and or incompetent. That both a gibbering schizophrenic homeless man and a successful businessman from a resented ethnic group can be a them demonstrates something crucial. Different types of thems evoke different feelings in us, anchored in differences in the neurobiologies of fear and disgust. As but one example, fear-evoking faces cause us to watch vigilantly and activate the visual cortex. Disgust-evoking faces do the opposite. We carry various taxonomies in our heads as to our relationships with different types of others. Thinking about some thems is simple. Consider someone who pushes all our judgmental buttons, say a homeless junkie whose wife threw him out of the house because of his abusiveness and who now mugs elderly people. Throw him under a trolley. People are most likely to agree to sacrifice one to save five when the five are in-group members and the one is this extreme of an out-group. But what about thems who evoke more complex feelings? Tremendously influential work has been done by Fisk with her stereotype content model. This entire section concerns that work. We tend to categorize thems along two axes. Warmth is the individual or group a friend or foe, benevolent or malevolent, and competence. how effectively can the individual or group carry out their intentions? The axes are independent. Ask subjects to assess someone about whom they have only minimal information. Priming them with cues about the person's status alters ratings of competence, but not of warmth. Prime them about the person's competitiveness, and you do the opposite. These two axes produce a matrix with four corners. There are groups that we rate as being high in both warmth and competence. Us, naturally. And Americans typically view this group as containing good Christians, African-American professionals, and the middle class. And there's the other extreme, low in both warmth and competence, our homeless, addicted mugger. Subjects typically hand out low warmth / low competence assessments for the homeless, people on welfare, and poor people of any race. Then there's the high warmth / low competence categorization, the mentally disabled, people with handicaps, the elderly. Footnote, with a reminder that competence is used not in the everyday sense where low competence would seem pejorative, but simply as a measure of agency. And the categorization of low warmth, high competence. It's how people in the developing world